From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. From Wikipedia to YouTube, from Firefox to Facebook, the world is coming together online. Today, the power of the group and the we generation. Fourth graders look back on a year of building community.
We spend more time with each other than our family each day, except for the weekends. I knew very few people when I came into this class on the first day of school, but now I know everyone.
Harry Potter fans come together.
All you witches and wizards out there, are you ready to burn Voldemort's butt?
Yeah! Ladies and gentlemen, Harry and the Potter!
And if you're feeling alone, like the only one in the world, you'll find emotional soulmates at wefeelfine.org.
In a way, you could say that this world of blogging is kind of like a global Prozac, where it makes everybody kind of, you know, approach the medium and feel more or less the same.
Also, a new discovery might prove we're hardwired to connect. We'll find out the latest on mirror neurons. Clay Shirky popularized the phrase, "The internet runs on love." He should know. Shirky writes about the net and new technologies for The New York Times and The Wall Street Journal, and teaches at New York University's Interactive Telecommunications Program. "Here Comes Everybody" is the title of his latest book. Shirky told Steve Paulson that the networking potential of the net is immense and surprising. Just look at the story of a New York woman's missing cell phone.
This happened in May of 2006. A woman named Ivana lost her cell phone in the back of a cab. It was a fairly expensive phone, a Sidekick, which had a screen and a camera and so on. It also had, unfortunately for her, all the details of her wedding, which was coming up in a few days, and she had caterers, details, guest lists, and so forth on it. So she went to a friend of hers, Evan Gutman, who at the time worked in the financial industry, and said, "Send an email to the phone saying reward if found." Well, they sent the email. Nothing happens. A couple days later, she buys a new phone, and her phone company says, "Oh, you know, we've got all the data on our servers as well. We've cached a copy. Do you want us to put it on your new phone?" And she said, "Yes, absolutely." So she gets all the data on the new phone, and not only does she now have her address book back, she also has the face and email address of the woman who now has the phone, who's a 16-year-old living in Queens. And so they have her email address, they have her photo, they're very quickly able to find her MySpace page on the social networking site she frequents, and they begin communicating with her directly. And Sasha, that was this girl's name, refused to give the phone back on the age-old logic of finders keepers. And this so enraged Evan and Ivana that they started documenting everything about the attempt to get the cell phone back. And Evan put it up on his site, evanwashere.com. It's under the heading Stolen Sidekick. And it caught people's eye. It ended up on the front page of Dig, which is a social news service. And unbeknownst to Sasha, even as they were negotiating with this 16-year-old to get this phone back, first thousands, then tens of thousands, and ultimately millions of people were tuning in worldwide to watch this thing unfold. It made the front page of the New York Times, it made CNN, and so forth.
And meanwhile, there were also threats. Sasha's brother and her boyfriend were telling Evan, "Lay off or else."
Right. I mean, rather remarkably, Sasha, yeah, as you say, Sasha's boyfriend and her brother, who at least claimed to be in the military police, weren't just saying she's not going to give the phone back. They were actually threatening at various points either physical violence or a lawsuit for harassment, even though they clearly had stolen property in their possession. And this actually served only further to enrage Evan and Ivana. And so there was this kind of war of words building up. And as I said in the book, right, from Sasha's side, all of the threats and attempts to get the, you know, keep the phone had this kind of you and what army quality about them, because they were thought they were just negotiating with some, you know, person in Manhattan who really didn't have a lot of support and who really wasn't going to spend a lot of time or energy getting back a $300 phone. And they were so wrong. They were so spectacularly wrong. Evan did have an army of sorts. He didn't just get an audience, right? He got people offering him legal advice. He got people videotaping the house for him. He got people offering to explain to him. Actually, a New York City cop explained to him how to get the phone reclassified from lost merchandise, about which the New York Police Department would do nothing, to stolen merchandise. And when he finally did that, lo and behold, the cops went out to the house. They recovered the phone. They arrested Sasha. And it really, that event couldn't have happened even a couple years before, What Evan, as a private citizen, was able to avail himself of was both a media platform and a collaborative set of tools that simply haven't been in the hands of ordinary citizens and now are.
It's an amazing story. I guess I wonder if this is just a remarkably unusual story, that something like this just took off, or are we seeing more of this?
That story is unusual in that the next time someone loses a phone, it doesn't get nearly the attention. In fact, there's a famous case in Canada of a car being stolen, and a community of really a vintage car appreciators came around and helped recover it. But it didn't make the international press anymore. So there is a kind of unique quality about that particular story. What's not, I think, unique is the idea that ordinary citizens can now participate in the media environment, and that that participation is different than them just behaving like tiny professional media outlets. You get novel kinds of effects, like the recovery of this phone, once media is really something that we all participate in rather than something that we all just consume and only a small professional class participates in.
And this also extends to journalism itself. I mean, it's no longer just
Absolutely.
A matter of reading the New York Times or watching your local TV news. I mean, people, average people out there can be journalists. If they start their own blogs, they can actually report stuff and in some cases break big stories.
Absolutely. One of my favorite examples from this is Alisar Chirapongse, who blogs. She's a Thai fashion student living in Bangkok and blogs under the name Gnarly Kitty. And she just blogged about her life. It was all shoes and going out to the clubs and so forth and so on. And then one day she wakes up and there's a coup in Thailand. So she gets her camera and she goes out, and she is one of the first people to upload pictures of tanks in front of the parliament building. Now, when the coup happened, the military in Thailand shut down the traditional press, but they didn't shut down the blogosphere. And so Chirapongse became one of the primary sources for photographic evidence of what was going on inside the country, not because she was a trained journalist, but because she had access to both the means of production, the camera, and the means of distribution, her weblog. When ordinary citizens can generate the kind of media that makes the ruling party look unfavorable, it is a much harder thing to deal with than just trying to figure out how do we shut down traditional media. These people aren't journalists, right? They're just committing acts of journalism. And there's a great post in Chirapongse's blog a few days later where she started talking about a Hello Kitty phone she liked. And then people were complaining like, no, you know, forget the phones. We're not interested in the phones. Get back to the coup. And she has this wonderful post where she says, look, this blog is about me and my life. One of the things that happened in my life is there was a coup in my country. But another thing that's happening in my life is I really like this Hello Kitty phone. And if you don't like it, get out. I'm not here for you. And that I think illustrates the difference between professional journalists, defined as a category by membership, versus acts of journalism, where sometimes people are documenting a coup and sometimes they're documenting a Hello Kitty phone, and they don't actually make a big distinction between those two activities.
Now, why is all this taking off so much right now? Is it tapping into the inherent social nature of human beings, that we want to interact with other people?
Yeah, that's absolutely it. The technology is only an enabler. And in fact, one of the things I say in the book is this stuff doesn't get socially interesting until it gets technologically boring. There are almost no stories in the book that use anything other than the most rudimentary technology, right? There's an email list over here, some people doing IM over there, there's a website. It's really all stuff that was pretty much perfected in the 90s. The big shift now isn't technological achievement, it's social density, right? It's the fact that in industrialized societies, a majority of the population now doesn't just have access to these tools, but uses them and is completely comfortable with them. And because of that, right, for instance, in the presidential campaign we're seeing right now, the use of the internet as a fundraising tool, as a campaigning tool, as a propaganda tool, and so forth, is not only taking off by leaps and bounds, it's very often being advanced by the users. Particularly for Obama, many of the most successful Obama videos, whether it's Obama Girl or Will I Am or the recent young Hillary Clinton video, are not produced by the campaign nor are they distributed by the campaign. And that changed, right? We've been stuck in the 20th century with an only consume model of media, right? Someone beams something at you, and if you have any reaction, it's spluttering over at breakfast to your wife about how stupid the editorial is or what have you, or yelling back at the radio or the TV. But now we've got a media environment where people can consume, but we can also produce and we can share. And because we like to do those things, technology that enables those things is now leading to this enormous amount of experimentation with new forms of media that are involving the audience rather than just treating them passively.
Now, there's obviously something very exciting about all of this. I mean, there's a democratic nature to bringing in lots of people and not just the so-called experts. But there is some value in having gatekeepers out there. I mean, without them, you get a lot of yelling, you get racist comments, you get people getting trashed. I mean, should we worry about this?
You know, I don't think we should worry about the fact of those things. They happened before. What I think we should worry about is not having an environment where that's all there is, right? You need both civil and uncivil discourse on the internet, just as you need both civil and uncivil discourse really in any part of society. And so some places, when you go there, if you go to some open forums on the internet, right, you will find exactly this kind of racist ranting. Ken Lane has just written a wonderful thing about the incredible racism and misogyny that comes out in the comments about anything having to do with either Obama or Hillary's campaign. And it seems almost spring-loaded. What Lane says is basically, no matter what article I write, I know you stupid people are going to come in and make these kinds of comments. But then you go to places like Boing Boing, which is a human-moderated conversational network, right? The Boing Boing weblog, very highly trafficked, has a person look over every comment by an anonymous user before posting it. And so that is a very civil and informative environment. Certainly, if I had to pick between those two models, I'd go for the civility. But I'd much rather have both of them working side by side, because in some cases there are places where pure freedom of speech is a bracing tonic. And then in other places, you absolutely want the kind of degree of control that lets people actually hear each other talk. And we're still in a really experimental phase with all this. That, I think, is one of the remarkable things going on, is that all of this energy is going off in all directions trying to figure out how do we harness the social value of this new environment.
Clay Shirky is an internet expert and the author of the book Here Comes Everybody. Steve Paulson spoke with him. Ever wonder what the rest of the world is feeling? You can get a taste on the website wefeelfine.org, which trolls the web for blogs that contain the phrase, "I feel," then post them in all sorts of interesting and artistic, interactive ways. Here's a taste of the emotional palette on a random Tuesday.
I feel sunny.
I feel so sad. I just want to call him.
I feel like crap.
I feel in a daze, and I'm missing my friend, finding it hard to think that I'll never see or hear him again.
I feel as if Shopko could be taking better advantage of me, for lack of a better phrase.
I feel like utter crap.
I feel alive.
I feel like destroying something beautiful.
I feel guilty about not going to my sister's graduation.
I feel the world falling apart in my hands.
I feel like a liar in a world of liars.
I feel like one of the reasons women choose to get dolled up is because they're afraid to be overshadowed and or compared to more attractive women.
I feel loved. I feel electric. I'm not sure what's about to happen, but it has me wide awake.
I feel like a complete failure today.
I feel safe here.
A sampling of some emotions captured from the world's blogs from the website wefeelfine.org. Jonathan Harris created the site with Sepp Kemvar to make the world seem a little smaller, and to help people see the beauty in the ups and downs of everyday life. Harris told Steve Paulson that the site captures new feelings from blogs every 3 minutes.
People feel a lot of things. We track about 6,000 different emotions in We Feel Fine, and that list is more or less a list of adjectives from Webster's Dictionary. Then we removed some adjectives that wouldn't really make sense as a feeling, but more or less it's a list of all adjectives. And that we find that there are some that are very, very commonly used, like better is the most common feeling, almost by an order of magnitude, followed by good and bad and right and alone, which are all very common. And then there's kind of a long tail from there that goes on and on and on and on and on until you can see, you know, people who feel purple or people who feel paranoid. And there's just all manner of emotion that is being expressed all the time on the internet. And it really doesn't matter from where. I mean, the project only tracks English language blogs, but they come from all over the world. And you find that people feel the same range of things no matter where they live, more or less.
So do you think anything changes once this goes public, I guess you could say? I mean, because in the past it was, you know, pretty much people writing in their diaries or, you know, writing a personal letter or maybe singing a song that would communicate some of this, but not sort of putting it out there for potentially the whole world to see.
Well, I think that one thing that's different is not so much on the side of the author, but on the side of the reader, and that is that I think one thing that people realize when they look at blogs and specifically when they look at We Feel Fine is that they say, oh my God, there are so many other people going through the same thing I'm going through right now. And I think that realization is a relatively new one. I think in the past people were maybe much more accustomed to suffering alone, thinking they were the only person in the world going through a given feeling or a given emotion. But you go onto a site like We Feel Fine and there are thousands of people feeling depressed in your hometown on that day in the same weather conditions. And there are, you know, countless examples of this kind of empathy. And so I think that that's a very heartening thing for people to realize that I'm actually not alone. There are a lot of other people going through exactly what I'm going through right now. And on the flip side of that, when people are feeling positive things, like I'm feeling so overjoyed, I'm feeling so happy, in a way, it cuts down those feelings of euphoria a little bit because you don't feel so special. There are also other people feeling euphoric and overjoyed and happy. And so your own feeling of happiness maybe doesn't feel as unique. So I think that it cuts both ways. In a way, you could say that this world of blogging is kind of like a global Prozac where it makes everybody kind of, you know, approach the median and feel more or less the same.
Well, what's fascinating about going through and sort of clicking on a lot of these things on your site is, I mean, these are, as you say, universal emotions in some way. I mean, I went in and said, you know, I found people who would say, you know, I feel really yucky today or I feel back to normal. But then there's often this level of specificity, like I feel really bad because I'm playing piano for the senior farewell song and I think Carrie really wanted to.
Yeah.
Or I feel it is crucial to inform you that we are in the process of starting a new church.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's when you start to realize that there are so many different aspects of a given feeling. There's so many different things that can cause you to feel a certain way. And there's often incredible poetry in what people write. I mean, one of my favorite sentences from this project was collected very, very early on in October of 2006, I believe, or maybe even 2005. And it's a photograph of a man standing on a beach in the sand holding a little girl in his arms, and the sun is setting behind them, and you can see the horizon line and the ocean and the line of the sand. And the sentence that goes with that says, I feel so much of my dad alive in me that there isn't even room for me. Mm. And I just find that incredibly beautiful, and I look at that so often. And so this was this act of unintentional poetry, that somebody had written that sentence in a blog post, presumably about her dad, and then had included that photograph with the post, and those two things got automatically combined together to form one of these montage compositions.
Do you notice many differences from country to country? I mean, are you willing to speculate at all based on this rather random sample of what you see on We Feel Fine about, let's say, which are the happiest countries?
We've done some interesting findings with word correlation. So we've looked at all of the people who feel happy, and we've looked at the other words that they tend to use while they're talking about their feelings of happiness. And we've found that certain words co-occur among those people at a much higher rate than they would typically co-occur in a normal corpus of English language usage. So, for example, we found love to be the most common cause of happiness. So that would mean that the word love co-occurs roughly twice as often among happy people as it does among everybody else. We've also found that music is something that makes people feel happy, performing music and also listening to music, as does good food and having a good job. So there are little funny things like this. And then, you know, there are other feelings like sexy, for example. We found that two leading causes of people feeling sexy are haircuts and high boots. So there are all sorts of really funny little tidbits that come up. And this third one, you won't even believe, but I promise you it's true. And we actually thought this was an anomaly in our data when we found it. But the number one thing that people feel sorry for at an overwhelmingly strong rate, roughly four times the normal level, is Britney Spears, which is also bizarre. We thought it was an anomaly in the data, but we really looked into it and found it to be true. When people talk about feeling sorry, they often say, I feel sorry for Britney Spears. So that was interesting, too.
Do you have some favorite comments that you've read over the last few years that just have stayed with you?
Yeah, certainly the one I mentioned about the girl and her dad was really moving for me. Another one was, it's a photograph of a woman's torso. You can't see her head and you can't see her legs. It's just her torso. And she's wearing some kind of lingerie, almost like a corset or like a bra piece thing. And she's obviously taking this photograph of herself. And the sentence that goes with it says, I need to be in some backwoods redneck town so that I can feel beautiful. Hmm. And I find that simultaneously really funny and also really sad. And that's one that's always really stuck with me.
Mm-hmm. Anything else?
There's so many. I mean, and a lot of the really beautiful ones are best seen for real because there are these words and photographs that go together. So to really feel the moment, you have to see the photograph. But, you know, there's another girl that took a picture of her wrist as she'd obviously cut herself with a knife, and it's just a picture of her wrist, and it said, I wouldn't hide it if society didn't make me feel like I needed to. Hmm. And, you know, so some really personal dark moments that people are putting on their blogs. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you have some incredibly hopeful ones. There's one of a photograph of the ocean, and it's a dark, stormy day with thick gray, blue clouds hanging overhead, and it's very, very dark. And then there's a single beam of sunlight coming down through the clouds, illuminating a patch of the water. And it says, I feel like I'm in the center of that light circle. So there's some really beautifully uplifting ones as well.
It's a world of laughter, a world of tears. It's a world of hope and a world of fears. There's so much that we share that it's time we're aware. It's a small world after all.
For a link to wefeelfine.org, stop by our website. It's ttbook.org. You can leave us a comment while you're there. We always love to hear from you. Coming up, Harry Potter, the boy who lived, goes right on living in his fan community. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. One of the things the web has done is to make it possible for people to come together around shared interests. Nowhere is that more evident than in the truly massive and ever-growing subculture of Harry Potter fans. A new documentary about the phenomenon is making the rounds of independent film festivals. It's called We Are Wizards. Filmmaker Josh Curry told Anne Strainchamps he got interested in the Harry Potter fan culture when he discovered there's a hugely popular underground music scene called Wizard Rock.
The first people we met were a group called Harry and the Potters that actually started in 2002, I believe. Through their popular music, they spawned a whole generation of new people who are doing that. And there's probably about 300 or 400 wizard rock bands out there right now, which is kind of incredible.
Are you witches and wizards out there? Are you ready to burn Voldemort's butt?
Yeah! Ladies and gentlemen, Harry and the Potters!
Their
there's a band that dress like Harry Potter.
I guess I resembled Harry Potter a little bit. Wizard rock.
It's a genre now. Everybody's picking names.
We're Draco and the Malfoys.
I'm the Whomping Willow.
A lot of my friends were like, what are you doing? And we're like, we're going on tour. And they're like, why? Who wants to see you play?
Are these at all professional, or are they kind of high school kids playing rock in their garages?
Well, it definitely varies from the very professional. I think Harry and the Potters and Draco and the Malfoys both are profiled in our film, We Are Wizards. Some of the best, you know, not only their group, but also as musicians, I think they're extraordinarily talented. But it does definitely range. Another set are the Hungarian Horntails, and they're two little guys, 7 years old and 4 years old, who started their band and kind of sang like a punk rockish type of music through the eyes of the Hungarian Horntails, which are the dragons in the Harry Potter world.
This is like a baby Partridge Family.
Yeah, that's what they said in the movie. That's kind of the way they envision themselves. Both of the parents have bands as well, and I think that they kind of all inspire each other. In a lot of ways, they kind of, the Hungarian Horntail family, which is, they call them the Horntail family, you know, they symbolize a lot of what Wizard Rock is about. It's about music, and it's about inspiration. It's about, you know, creating music, but also creating music within your peers and within your family structures and within your friends and doing what you feel like you can do.
What kind of things do the Wizard Rock bands sing about?
Well, it's all through the eyes of the characters. So if you take Draco and the Malfoys, they're Draco Malfoy in the books is the evil the opposite of Harry in the student world. And, you know, Draco and the Malfoys sing about how Harry Potter is a kind of a crappy kid and not very good and all this stuff.
My dad is rich and your dad is dead. My dad is rich and your dad is dead. Your dad on his journey to the great beyond. When you're dueling, you might see him come out of someone else's wand. My dad is rich and your dad is dead.
Do these groups have a big fan base?
It's enormous, especially with some of the top players. You know, they're all on MySpace. That's generally how they're networked. And Harry and the Potters has maybe 100,000 plus friends, incredible networks. They go on tour. And, well, just as an example, part of the film shows the last book release. They played in Harvard Square, and they had 30,000 plus people at that show. So it's pretty big.
That's sort of unbelievable.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
We wanted the same rights that any fan should have. Apparently this letter campaign that Warner Brothers had started had been going on for months.
It makes you think that corporations have these sleeper agents in like trench coats and hats and they're just looking for people.
If you threaten one of us, you're going to threaten all of us. I orchestrated a worldwide boycott. Anything that was Harry Potter was off limits.
So besides the Wizard Rockers, what are some of the other ways Harry Potter fans are extending the books and making them their own?
Well, lots of things. You know, one of the characters in our movie, Heather Lawver, in 2001 started a group called Potter War, which was essentially, you know, after Warner Brothers had picked up the copyright in 2001 from J.K. Rowling, they started to, you know, shut down fan websites just to, you know, keep control of what was going on the internet. And she felt like this was an injustice. So she formed a group called Potter War, a global group that ultimately was a boycott on all Warner Brothers products. And ultimately, because of the resistance that they had going on, it was substantial and significant. They did enough financial damage and PR damage that Warner Brothers eventually started to, you know, change their tune a bit.
Give me an idea of what sort of online activities Warner Brothers was subjecting to. For instance, there's a guy you profile who created a website, Wizard People?
Yes, it was called Wizard People, Dear Readers. Actually, what it was he had taken the first film, Harry Potter and Sorcerer's Stone, and kind of just did an alternative soundtrack over it, just spoke over it while he played the movie. And essentially, it just started as a joke for his friends.
Out from the shadows of God knows what dimension steps the oldest wizard in the books, the near-dead Dumbledore. He is clearly a powerful beast, and walks with dignity despite his age and attire.
Eventually, it started getting rented out at a local movie rental place in Austin, Texas, and then it got on the web, and then people started hearing it. It started playing at film festivals, New York and Chicago and L.A. It was playing everywhere. And then eventually, Warner Brothers said, okay, you know, enough's enough.
Sort of suggests that what we're witnessing with the Harry Potter fan culture is really the birth of a new kind of community. You know, that this is possible in a way it simply wasn't before.
Yeah, that's very true. Take, for example, which is not in our movie, but some people, it's definitely one of the popular things out there right now that has to do with Harry Potter. There's a thing called Potter Puppet Pals, which is primarily on YouTube. It's this younger guy, I think he's 19 now. He just made these little puppets and created these comedic pieces with the Harry Potter characters, and it's exploded on YouTube, and he's getting millions and millions of hits, and I'm not sure if he's being recognized or not, but you see that kind of thing happening all the time.
So much for all the parents who say, get off the computer.
Yeah, exactly.
And head out into the sun. Do something real.
Well, that's one of the things, too, that I think is special about the Harry Potter fan culture. Unlike some other cultures that have existed in the past, this isn't something that happens, you know, in your basement in front of your computer at all. This is empowering kids to not only create work, but then to also get out on stage and sing songs and be out there on the road and doing it, taking on tour. I think when you look at Hungarian Horntools, who are 7 and 4 years old, you know, they'll play in front of 500 plus people at a show. You know, that is something that I never had an opportunity to experience. I probably wouldn't be able to do that now, you know, and let alone when I was 7 and 4. And these kids are doing it because of, you know, I don't want to use a cliche, but because of the power of the internet and all these things, I think people get inspired to go do that. And it's ultimately creating, you know, an army of creative intellectuals that are about to explode into our social scene. Yeah.
Harry Potter said right into Ron's soul, you know what we are, baby. We are wizards. We are finally what we were always going to become. We are wizards, and the world better get ready, because I have just begun.
Josh Khoury talked with Anne Strainchamps about his new film, We Are Wizards. As kids today spend more and more time in online communities, parents wonder whether they're learning enough about how to deal with people in the flesh. How to get along with people you might not want to put on your Facebook page, but who do happen to live next door to you. Well, not to worry. Anne Strainchamps has been shadowing her son's fourth grade class all year, microphone and recorder in hand. She found that besides learning fractions, long division, and how to spell exasperate, the kids in the class also learned something even more valuable, what it means to be part of a community.
When I started in fourth grade in this class, it was sort of like, who's this, who's that? Now it's like, oh, that's Sam and that's Kim, and we know each other more than just calling names out.
I think we have grown a lot closer to each other. We spend more time with each other than our family each day, except for the weekends. I knew very few people when I came into this class on the first day of school, but now I know everyone.
Back in September, 26 10-year-olds walked into room 206 at Randall Elementary School in Madison, Wisconsin. They filled their desks with new pencils and glue sticks and spiral-bound notebooks, and then they set about the hard work of getting to know each other and their teacher.
My name is Wenda, and I lived in Madison most of my life, and my family loves going to the Mississippi River.
Hi, my name is Bennett, and I'm Jewish, and I like dogs.
My name is Nantini, and my parents come from Ivory Coast.
My name is Nikki, and I love to play soccer.
My name's Henry, and all I like to do is fish.
They were still feeling each other out at that point, figuring out who liked kickball and who preferred foursquare, who played fair and who didn't. It's a pretty diverse class, white kids, black kids, Latino, Hmong. And one of the ways they began to get to know each other was by writing poems and reading them to each other. They wrote about themselves.
I am from a soft, fluffy, white bed.
cold, delicious tuna fish sandwiches and went sighting water parks.
I am from delicious cookie dough ice cream and 30-yard passes, from a 2-point shot and jumping into a 3-foot leaf pile.
I'm from cold chocolate chip ice cream and nice, beautiful, smelly socks.
From the first time I ran a hot, sweaty mile.
From hot, steaming latkes right off the pan.
From climbing high, rough trees and pretty, beautiful ballet shoes.
I am from the bright sunrise that shines through my window and the smell of hot, crunchy, oily egg rolls.
I am from Honduras in America and from saying hello, hola, to make lots of friends.
I am from Get Up, It's Time for School.
And they also wrote about their feelings.
I want to be black. Blackness of this touches your very, very soul. I want to be black. Black like the dark that you sleep in. I want to be black. Black like Michael Jordan. I want to be black. Black like Ruby Bridges. I want to be black.
As September rolled into October and on into the blustery days of November, the kids in room 206 began to change.
At the beginning of the year, a lot of us just played in groups of like twos or threes, and now a lot of us are playing in like groups of tens and stuff.
Maybe we were playing kickball, and there are unfair teams, and people would yell at each other, and now we'll just ask each other, can you go over here? And it's not like we're wanting someone because they're a better kicker or a better pitcher, just because we should be happy and fair to everyone.
So what made them change? A lot of it was what they were doing in class.
Who's in the red group?
You're over there.
Who's in the blue group?
Hey, don't start yet!
Besides working on multiplication and long division and writing book reports, the kids also worked on a series of team-building exercises. Stress challenge, they called it.
Your Mr. Potato Head has to look like this.
This is the Mr. Potato Head challenge. There are 6 teams. Each team has to construct a complete Mr. Potato Head, but the only team member who's allowed to touch anything is blindfolded. All the others can do is give directions.
7 minutes.
Okay, move your hand back.
No.
Move your hand back.
Stop. He's
No, feel it.
Out.
It's
the head. Get the head. Right here.
Right here.
That's the ear. You're trying to put the ear in the head.
Put your arm closer.
Closer. Closer to the center.
Quiet. Don't feel.
Quiet.
Where are the eyes? Where you put in the eyes? Yes.
After weeks of this, they're ready for an even bigger challenge, an overnight field trip to a cave.
Some of us weren't really friends before we went caving, but in the cave, we helped people through, other people helped us through, and that really made us a good us.
Think of it as Outward Bound for 10-year-olds. By now it was winter. The weekend they went caving, it was cold outside and there was heavy snow predicted. The cave was in the middle of nowhere, and to get into it, they had to rappel down a long rope and then crawl on their hands and knees in the dark.
We had to go down some rocks, and then there was this tight little space that we had to squeeze through to get into the cave.
There was this sharp turn. You're crawling through this 2x3 opening, and then there was this sharp turn, and then you popped out.
I remember that I was afraid of going down the rope. Sam was supporting me and telling me that it wasn't so hard.
You know, at school, not everybody is so like as fond of each other as they usually were. But at camp, if somebody was in a tight space, almost anybody, even if they didn't really like that person, but they would go and help out because we made new friends on that trip, and I thought it was really nice.
As the kids changed and grew over the course of the year, and as they learned to trust and depend on each other, they also began to apply what they were learning about being in community in other ways.
Box City was a city that we made completely out of boxes. It was supposed to be a perfect community, all homes for everyone, accessible for all, sustainable and green.
We made it all out of like recycled materials, boxes, We used a lot of different stuff.
Oh, that's neat. And you have a rooftop garden?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool, I'll tell you about mine.
Okay.
Well, we took like maybe a whole week just to plan one building for each of us.
We have a beauty salon called
African American Hair Specialist.
We recycle and it's a really fun place to be, and you can get your kids and they play outside in the backyard.
My favorite thing was sitting down with the whole group and figuring out where stuff was going to go, because when we did that, we didn't get in an argument. It was sort of just like we were a community as a class, and it was just nice having everybody have their ideas and not argue or nothing.
Planning a dream city, their ideal community, and building a working model of one got the kids thinking even more deeply about what it means to be part of a community and what it takes to sustain one. By the end of the year, their thinking on the subject had become deep and rich. And in their last month of school, they revisited their old poetry unit and started to put some of what they'd learned into words.
A green community is like a large old oak tree breathing like a child resting on his mom's lap.
A green community is a field of grass. It is a city of grass that has grown for many years.
A grateful community is a lion. Grateful for the prey he hunts, grateful for the water hole he drinks from. He makes everyone grateful as he passes, grateful for the things they have.
A thankful community is all friends standing together, making each other's lives happier.
Fourth grade is winding to a close now. Soon, the kids in room 206 will slam their locker doors for the last time. They'll race outside, more than ready for summer vacation. But come next September, they'll be back, with new lunchboxes and freshly sharpened pencils. It's possible they will have forgotten how to multiply fractions, but I bet they remember what it felt like to say this.
Hi, we're Mrs. Ginsburg's class.
And Strange Champs produced that story. Coming up, why we might be hardwired to make connections. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. I've heard Sartre's famous quote, "Hell is other people." Turns out, as much as we might like to disassociate from our human counterparts, it's not in our nature. According to new research, human beings are hardwired for things like empathy, compassion, and connection. Scientists have recently discovered something called mirror neurons. Marco Iacoboni is the author of Mirroring People. He says the discovery of mirror neurons looks to be a crucial part of how human beings connect with each other.
I think it's a fundamental way in which evolution has shaped our brains such that we can understand each other at a very simple level and immediately. And this is very important because when I interact with people, I really have to feel comfortable. I really have to feel that I understand what they're doing, what they're going to do next. I have to predict what they do. And if I have these cells in my brain, that's something that I can do easily, automatically. And that makes me comfortable. And then we can actually understand each other's minds.
Well, I guess where we have to start is with mirror neurons. What are they?
These are cells that were discovered in the monkey brain, and they have properties that scientists couldn't even imagine that they could exist. They fire when you make an action, say grasping a cup, and when you're completely still, you're not moving your body, but you see somebody else making the same action. So it almost seems that With these cells, you can actually simulate what other people are doing.
Are these cells that are found all over the brain?
Well, in the monkey brain, they're found in two specific brain regions. In the human brain, it's not clear because we can't really see individual cells with brain imaging. But we have a sense that it's actually much more expanded, these brain cells.
And what they do seems pretty broad. It covers all kinds of activity. It's essentially a connection between humans?
That's right. I mean, what they do is to code different kinds of actions of the self and the other people. And the idea is that, in fact, they really make strong connections between people.
One of the things that fascinated me was in the research that you did with macaques. I think the example that was given was of the neurons firing when the monkey tore a piece of paper.
Right.
And then firing again when watching a researcher tear a piece of paper.
Correct.
And then firing again when hearing a piece of paper being torn.
Just the sound of the action.
Which suggests that there is a greater awareness of the connection between self and other than we would have guessed. So do you know how these are fired, or are you only guessing as to the connection?
Well, what we know is that they are located in certain brain regions. They respond in certain situations. One of the questions is, how do they get formed? How in the brain we have these cells? One idea is that there can be some genes that code for these cells. But another possibility is that these cells are actually shaped by experience. The example I always give in my seminars is the following. There's plenty of imitation that goes back and forth between the baby and the caregiver. For instance, the baby smiles, and the mother smiles back because she's pleased that the baby is smiling and is happy. It's very easy for the baby's brain to make an association between the mother smiling and the sight of somebody else smiling. And there you have a mirror neuron.
You've touched me. I have a 4.5-month-old grandson who is doing exactly that. And you see, you smile, he smiles. You laugh, he laughs. It isn't entirely clear that he knows what he's doing at this point, but it does seem to be an interaction. I wouldn't have thought of that connection with mirror neurons, but you're suggesting that's exactly what's going on.
I believe that that's exactly going on. That's exactly what shapes mirror neurons very early on in life. You can make a little experiment. You go to a gathering in which there are grown-ups and babies. You start imitating the baby. You become immediately the most popular grown-up in the whole party because babies love to be imitated. It's a very simple way of connecting with other people, and it's very powerful.
So what does this mean for those adults who don't connect very well with others? Are their mirror neurons not firing?
Yeah, that's the idea. I mean, for instance, we know that areas that we think contain mirror neurons in the human brain have reduced activity in patients with autism. Patients with autism have a problem connecting with others, understanding the mental states of other people. And so we think that a deficit in these cells lead to a deficit in social behavior.
Looking at these cells, do you see evidence of why then we seem to share the feelings of others, even though those feelings have no reason to affect us the way they do? If I see a woman crying, it's very hard not to cry, even though I have no idea why she's upset.
Yeah, I mean, they do two things, these cells. First of all, they explain what is called emotional contagion. And the other thing that they tell us is that we are really wired for empathy. This is a major revision of long-standing beliefs. Our traditional idea is that our biology makes us only individualists, that only care about themselves. And our ideas make us social. These cells are telling us a totally different story. Evolution made us wired for empathy.
We talked a little bit about the effect of mirror neurons on people with autism. We don't know very much about this at the moment, although you're speculating that their mirror neurons are underdeveloped.
Right.
What does it suggest, if anything, for treatment of children with autism?
I think that's really the exciting implication of this research, because even though we don't have complete evidence, we have very good inferential, data that are strongly suggesting that there is a deficit in mirror neurons in these patients, but we don't have direct evidence at the level of the single cell. On the other hand, some clinicians used our research and got inspired to do interventions that are based on imitation. So the idea is to use imitation as a form of intervention in this, especially in very young children with autism. And the results are really preliminary, but they seem to suggest really robust effects such that these patients get much better and do not improve simply their ability to imitate, but even language abilities. Through imitation, it seems that patients with autism can actually get much better in their ability to connect and to use language.
It's also what you're suggesting is that it's the reverse of what we have been trying. Instead of standing in front of them and behaving the way you want them to behave, you're standing in front of them and starting out by behaving the way they behave.
Exactly. And there's evidence that if you do that, in fact, people are going to like you. There are nice social psychology studies that suggest that if I imitate you and then I leave the room and somebody asks you, so what do you think about Marco? You're going to say, he's a nice guy. If I don't, you're going to say, well, I guess he's okay, but you're not going to be too excited about me. Imitation improves liking between people.
Does this study have practical effects for creating interaction between people on other levels? I mean, I know you have done some research with political focus groups, for instance, to find out whether people's mirror neurons are helping to define how they feel about candidates.
Right. That was my hypothesis, that in fact mirror neurons are important for identification. And although people, when they talk about politics, tend to put it at a very rational level, they evaluate the issues and so on, I think it's mostly about emotional connectedness and identification. And the more you identify with a candidate, the more you have mirroring activity. And we did an experiment in 2004, and the initial data were suggesting that. Unfortunately, that campaign became so nasty that very soon we saw the disappearance of those empathic responses in our voters.
Nobody cared about any of the candidates anymore.
Exactly.
And then, which left us to vote on rational basis, perhaps.
Or maybe just, you know, the more you dislike one candidate, the more you vote for the other one. But I think that it's, I think in the long term, this is bad news for democracy in general. What you want to have is a nice connectedness between the voters and the politicians. And a lot of, especially negative ads in politics, which we know they work. I think that in the long run, and that's what I also say in my book, what they do is they're going to create a disconnect between voters and the people that should represent the voters.
So where do you see your research going from here?
Well, the nice thing about it is it's going in so many different directions. I mean, of course, the most important one to me is the role of neuroscience in society. I mean, what the research is telling us is that our ideas, that our biology makes us individualists, and again, we have to overcome this tendency with some ideas and beliefs. The research that we are doing tells us exactly the opposite. In fact, we are wired for empathy. And so I think this is a very important message. So far, we didn't know this, and societies are built on explicit discourse, not on implicit kind of understanding, the one that works for mirror neurons. But the fact that now we know that that's the way our brain works, I think is going to have an impact on our society, and I think it's going to be a good impact.
Marco Iacoboni is a neurologist and neuroscientist at UCLA. He's the author of Mirroring People. It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, we'd love to hear from you. Send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program The We Generation, number 68B. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Veronica Rickert and Anne Strainchamps, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, and Doug Gordon. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.